Science is a systematic enterprise that builds and organizes knowledge in a form that can be tested, that is, it is replicable and experimented upon. Oh gosh, no, you have not tuned into a wrong podcast. This is not a Science 101. This is still Audible Weed Walk, and this is episode 11. Hi, this is Nina. Last week, the ecological community remembered and paid our homage to Alexander von Humboldt on his birth anniversary. Do you know who he was? He's quite an amazing character. Alexander von Humboldt was a Prussian naturalist and an explorer who explored much of the Central and the South America. He is pretty much considered the greatest explorer scientist of the 18th and the early 19th century. His contribution to science were remarkable and diverse. For example, the field of biodiversity, law of limiting factor, species-area relationship, mapping areas of similar pressure and temperatures, leading to modern meteorological science. He is much cherished in the ecological community for his contribution to biogeography. Now, what is biogeography? It is a study of the distribution of species and ecosystem in the geographic space and through ecological and through geological time. So last week, we looked at the distribution of the black nightshade, you know, the Mantakali, across the different continents. We'll be touching upon the subject of biogeography. So in a way, we kind of honored Alexander Humboldt. So by the way, I cannot not tell you a trivia about Humboldt. He actually absolutely wanted to come to India. And at that time, British East India Company was ruling most of India, so he had to seek permission from them. But he was not permitted. Why? Because East India Company deemed him to be a threat. He was known to be he was known for his intelligence and very liberal views. A deadly combination then and even today. So why am I telling you all this about in the podcast for Weed Walk? Well, if you ask me, what is not science, and for that matter, what is not art? I have quoted Rob Jackson, who is an ecology professor at the Stanford, to you before, saying, art makes us human, science makes us human. Art and science together enrich both fields and perhaps makes us better humans. So now let's bring it to our weeds. Have you heard the last podcast, which is the podcast number 10, which is focused on the various cousins of the wild nightshades around us? If you haven't, I highly recommend you to watch to hear that here in Auroville Radio site, or if you can find also in the Edible Weed Walk YouTube channel, which also has a subtitle. Some people find it easier. I do not know about you, but for me, it has changed the way I look at even the most well-known greens or kirei around me. Who around here in South India does not know about Mantakali? The black nightshade? Many would know how to recognize it from a distance. In this season, the ladies at the fringes of the market forage and bring some. If you are lucky, you can even find them in the supermarkets. And I have seen them definitely in our own PTDC. But since I came to know about the Solanum nigrum and Solanum americanum, both are present in India and both will be called Mantakali, it has been kind of, for me, opening like a box of chocolate. When I forage and or get a bunch of Mantakali kirei. Like, I'm all eager to know, what is it? Is it nigrum or is it americanum? Is there a mix? Sometimes when I purchase a bunch, I've actually found both in it. So how exciting. As if it's like a detective. You can nod at the plant and tell, I know who you are. And the two of you pretending to be one. All the plants in my coloring book are supported by peer-reviewed journal articles based on research. But such research, in which a peer review process is there and the publication is there, which is reliable, came much after the plants were actually being used with all due precautions in the different continents by a set of people who are unlikely to have communicated with each other. Don't you find that amazing? Imagine, removed by ocean in a separate continent in an era where travel and transcontinental information sharing was not easy, if not completely impossible. How is it that different continents, same or very closely related plants, were eaten or used as medicine and were pre-processed in exactly same way? Be it in the Greek, Native American, Russia's Volga Germans, or of course Africans across the continent and people in the Indian subcontinent were using the plants in the same way. All these knowledges, who gathered? Who guided them? Who told them what to eat and what not to eat? For me now, before I recommend someone to eat a plant, I ensure I at least have three or more peer-reviewed journal articles supporting it. It gives me a certain confidence and reliability. Who gave these people the confidence and the reliability to use the plants in a certain ways? Well, a short answer will be, life did it. Since until last 10,000 years back, humans were hunter-gatherers only and had to forage for survival. And there came a period before the settled agriculture came in. There came a period in which hunting-gathering was mixed with seasonal shifting cultivation. In some areas of the world, this shifting cultivation, often called Sweden farming, is still in practice. Actually, within India, the Eastern Ghats, which is the eastern side of the country, the peninsular India, and the northeastern India still practices substantial amount of shifting cultivation. So some continents I went to and went to the communities, they were completely nestled within the forest or in complete wild areas, very remote from anything you would think about modern life. Their life, lifestyle, livelihood, these are always takes, you know, as you go in there, it takes you back centuries. They are living histories and tradition in some ways. They practice shifting cultivation primarily. A few of them have settled agriculture, but a large part of their resource comes from the hunting and gathering still. While hunting are primarily done by men, usually groups of men, who then shares their find or their gathering to the entire, not just to those who have gone to the hunting. They actually share with the entire community. Gathering are still done by women. Gathering, processing, drying, sorting. Now, these knowledges and these resources are always common knowledge for common use. And that's so, you know, amazing about it. I would safely assume that it is primarily women who in all those cultures and continents gathered and used the black nightshades from the wild. Imagine, without the luxury of falling back into journal articles, books on pharmacology, internet, etc., they set out an inquiry, observation, testing and sharing of knowledge that is free for all. This is our tradition, human tradition, Indian tradition, the tradition of inquiry, to question, to test, to experiment, to share, and to progress. Anyway, as I had mentioned Humboldt here, I thought in our podcast, we could honor the unnamed women who patiently observed, learned, experimented, perfected, and how differently wild plants like Manthakali could be used. They were the original scientists, the original chefs, and they drew these patterns of plants and animals they cherished on the walls of their with their drawings or stitched them on their quilt, and they were the original artists too. I actually have, there will be four pictures that would be posted along with this podcast. Have a look at them. The first one is actually Pangaea. many of you know, this is how the continents were originally, all together huddled up. There were no separation between them or hardly any. And note where the location of India was. India actually have traveled, the subcontinent has traveled immensely. Probably the most well-traveled subcontinent of all in the world. And it's interesting to see that because now when Humboldtian science, basically as the science of biogeography, what it does it, when it, for example, in our Mantakali example, if we see that the same plant growing in different continent, we will, and if we can look at their soil condition, the weather condition, and the climatic condition they are growing in, perhaps they are similar. They could be very dissimilar too. What this science now tells us is that how similar were they? Were they originally anyway connected? Now the genetic study can actually establish very well if they were related and at what stage, what wing of the plants have diverged and become a separate species altogether. It's amazingly interesting if you look at it. And also sometimes you would feel that, oh my God, how come a plant from Australia travel all the way to in the North Americas? But you will find, you know, the science will then explore the roots that could possibly be there. And part of this root is originally how the continents were shaped and how they dispersed. Now, the second picture, which I could not find a picture of the plants primarily, but it is actually a biogeographic representation celebrating the world. It's a pretty picture. The third one is actually a painting on the wall, a worldly painting, which comes from the western part of our of India. It's a very simplistic orly painting. There are, you must have seen much more complicated and much more complex ones. This is a very simple orly painting, which has the house at the center. And that's where the, you know, the center of being, you know, for a woman who is going to hunt, hunting and gathering, their center of their activity is their house. And surrounding that, there is plant, animal, and the essentials of life are represented. And you see the plants and these essentials are very important. So these were where they actually honed their skills. And that's the knowledge. When we actually today eat a Mantakali saru, and as I told you in the last podcast, that was my favorite. It's basically the Solanum nigrum or Solanum americanum, whatever you have, Mantakali, the leaves of them steeped in water, then the water thrown out, and it's cooked in coconut milk. It's really awesome. But the way I'm eating it today is what actually has been found by the scientific observation by these women centuries back. And do one thing in honor of these women. Take a walk outside and observe what flowers and what is flowering now. See if you can, if they bloom in the morning or in the evening. How long before they actually wilt? How do they wilt? By the way, is there any insect actually eating them? How about pollinators? There's an interesting story about it. One of the earliest plant-animal interaction exercise I had as a student is, you know, I had to sit in Mundanturai Tiger Reserve on my own as there were other students were dispersed. And I had to observe a particular plant as it I was observing its plant phenology, that how the flower opens up and changes color. It actually when it started off as blue and then it shifted to red. Then I actually saw very interesting insects. This was, I was absolutely new student, so I was keeping very good observations. And years later, very recently, I actually found my notebook. It's quite amazing amount of sketches I had done sitting there. But it turned out to be what I thought was a pollinator, but actually chomping out the flower. So there are predators. And also, I found that another set of ants, I was very sure that they would be pollinators, but what they were doing is that they were making a hole in the stalk of the flower, and from the side they were going and basically stealing the nectar without actually pollinating. For pollinating, you have to actually enter the plant through the main gate. So basically they are making a back gate and stealing it. There's all kinds of interesting creatures and phenomena in nature if you actually observe. So maybe you will find some of them. Do you see any bees or butterflies pollinating? Or sometimes they are these tiny hoppers. If you find these tiny hoppers, observe them. They are intricately patterned and beautiful color. Like, the color combinations, I think the designers to have a look. Because there's blue, green, orange, and a touch of maroon in one single tiny insect. And most of the time, you didn't even observe it. So, wonder, are they actually pollinating or predating? The hoppers, I would be, suspect. You see that some leaves are healthy and others will have some telltale signs of white marks on them. As if somebody has drawn with a pen. Wonder where they are coming from? Who made them? If you know which plant it is, does not have to be wild, find out, if possible, what are their properties. No, you don't have to. No, actually, I would suggest steer clear about their uses. Let's keep the utilitarian interests aside. Let's focus on the plants themselves. They like moisture. Well, do they like moisture or well-drained soil or clay? If given the ideal condition, how tall are they supposed to go? Or are they prostrate, which means they spread, hugging the ground? More you can indulge, more you are in touch with those women and perhaps the children and the men also who had joined in, who relentlessly observed. We have no date to honor them for their signs and sharing of their knowledge, but we can honor them a little every day. More on this next time. Till then, stay well and stay safe.